Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Anastasia Beaverhausen, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, a.k.a. Captain Anhedonia. That's a new one. And welcome to Motherfuckers That I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know because sometimes I just need to be held. And hopefully today's guests may need to do that next hour or so. We'll see how that goes. This guy, I should say, is the manager for the Rialto Theater and also managed the Colony Theater. Basically, the Rialto and the Colony are art house theaters here in Raleigh. And he's basically the guy in Raleigh that people usually go to see art house movies. So, John Munson, welcome to the Krizzlecast.
Nice to be here.
Is that basically a good way to describe you and everything?
Yeah, I'm manager of the Rialto. I own a small part of it, and then I help book the Colony Theater as well. So
yeah, because they're part of Ambassador Entertainment, which is a local independent theater chain. Also has Mission Valley and Six Forks Stage and all that. And but Rialto and Colony basically involved with the low budget foreign films, art house, different types of situation. And I mean, when I first came down here, you know, this was the place that we would go to. When I say we, I mean the film critics here would screen films. That would you know, this would be our screening room. Somewhat. And sadly, the last couple of years or so, they haven't been the case, mainly because with the digital conversion of you know, film and distributors and theaters and everything, we've had to go to different theaters like, you know, Crossroads and North Hills and all that to see movies. And before we just started talking, you mentioned how the Rialto will be making that transition from film to digital.
Next week, we're very much looking forward to it. It's basically, not to put too fine a point on it, but film is dead. The major studios, the smaller studios have already been going down this track, but the major studios now are saying that pretty much by the end of this year, they're not going to be providing 35mm prints of their movies. And so it's, you know, adapt or die, essentially. So we're adapting.
And, so, yeah, because we actually, we talked about this on and off for the, you know, past, I don't know, year, couple of years or so, because now it's a big talk of how you just had to move things over to digital. I mean, just where you see, I mean, just basically, you know, film won't be a common part of the equation anymore.
Right, not here. I mean, I think that, on one hand, I'm very excited because organizations like the Raleigh Film Society are going to have an opportunity to show a number of things that they've not been able to show because there are digital copies of things, whereas it was becoming increasingly hard to find a screenable 35mm copy of certain titles. I mean,
you're talking about Cinema Inc.
And, Cinema Inc.
Yeah, because
exactly.
Like, was it the second Sunday of every month?
Second Sunday of every month. They've got a pretty good lineup. They've been doing it for 40 some years, I believe. So, but you know, there'd be times when I remember specifically when they showed Chinatown, and you would think Chinatown—that's a major film, a major American film. You think, well, of course there'd be a decent 35mm copy of that to show, and it was not a good print, and that was the best they could get because it costs a lot of money to make a 35mm print, especially, you know, when you're only making one or two copies of it. So I can see the appeal from the studio distributors' viewpoint. They're saving a lot of money by going to digital. They're, you know, that was what hung up the whole transition for the longest time, was that the people that were going to be saving all the money were not the people that were being asked to assume all this burden of buying these digital projectors, which are still not cheap. And, you know, the technology's been around for, you know, a while, and they're still, you know, north of $60,000 to get a decent one. So, and then you look at these like 14 and 15, 20 screen complexes, well, mm-hmm. you can do the math, it gets pretty brutal. So just for us to get one projector here, we had to sort of look at it as a long-term goal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we made the decision that we wanted to try to pay for it up front and avoid going to the banks, and mm-hmm. we did that, but we had to plan for it way in advance.
Yeah. So I mean, but also, how is it with the Colony?
Colony's transition will be coming. The plan right now, as I understand it, is we're going to be keeping one 35mm house there. We have, you know, Denver, the manager over the Colony, has got some pretty exciting film series over there. And he is plugged in with essentially some 35mm film collectors.
Yeah.
And so that's getting you some really obscure stuff that even with everything being on digital, there's still a few things that are not on digital.
Yeah,
yet,
and so. It's Denver Hill, the manager of the Colony.
Right,
so.
Right. Yeah, Denver Hill's a good guy to know when it comes to the the more obscure stuff. So.
Well, of course, it raises the question also about, well, just where does film lie in this? Because I just got through writing a story about the North Carolina Museum of Art and their auditorium and how they're trying to move along with the times of while moving from film to digital. And I think one commenter on the web page was saying how, you know, we shouldn't forget about this regular film projection, reel to reel, and everything. And just, you feel there'll be some backlash about that?
Maybe on the fringes. I mean, I know that the folks that their bread and butter movie watching is to go see the latest shoot 'em up or space opera or something. They're not going to care. Mm-hmm. But I think some folks, I mean, look, there's still a market for vinyl records, so there's going to be a nostalgia fringe, a traditionalist fringe that's going to want to have that option.
Yeah.
Technically the thing I like about it is the first viewing is going to be the same as the 10th viewing is going to be the same as the 100th viewing. You're not going to have any sort of degradation of the print. There's no risk of a lax projection of scratching the print. The print's not going to get dirty, which is, you know, you're always on top of that. And that's just you cannot avoid some of that with film. It's mm-hmm. going to get just the wear and tear and a little dirt on it, despite all your best efforts. So that I really like. But on the other hand, you know, one of the neat things about the film projector, and it's this technology has been pretty much the same since projectors started, it's a system set up to fool your eye, fool your brain. It's a shell game. And by the way it works, it sort of actively engages your brain. Mm-hmm. It's a series of still photographs that are so fast your brain is essentially fooled. So that is, when you go to watch a movie, you are actively involved. You know, your brain is actively involved with it. Now, digital technology, I'm no expert on it, but it works on a different, it's essentially screen different, you're not as actively engaged. So I think Roger Ebert had written an article on this back when it was just coming out, and I'm embarrassed to say I've never read it, but he was sort of questioning, you know, you watch TV in kind of a stupor, and you watch and movies in more of a edge of your seat sort of thing. So is the whole experience of going to see a movie going to be a little different? Because since you're having different parts of your brain stimulated, essentially, when you're watching. I mean, I don't know. I've not seen that many digital films. I've watched plenty of television, but sitting in a theater, I've watched maybe two digital films. So.
Well, there's also, of course, the issue. You keep mentioning how, you know, there can be many it's like, you know, things that could happen in film projection, but you also keep in mind what's going on with digital projection. I mean, you know, this isn't really a fail-safe thing. I mean,
it can crash. Yeah. Is it going to be like your home computer, and all of a sudden that projector there is the same projector that we've had since I've been here, and I got here in 1990, and the only things we've had to replace are when a part is just physically worn down. And you expect that sort of thing. Whereas this digital stuff, is this going to be like my home computer where, like, every 18 months I need to get an upgrade?
Yeah, exactly.
And it just becomes increasingly expensive as you go along. So.
And also, I don't know how the staff is around here, but, you know, they would also have to be well equipped with knowing what to do with digital projection.
Yeah, very much so. And it's going to be learning on the fly. I'm going to have to learn on the fly. I mean, next week is going to be kind of frantic because, I mean, Mission Valley is digital and Six Forks is digital. So at least we have people that are familiar, and we're getting the same kind of projectors they're getting. So we have people in this company who are familiar with it.
And what kind of projectors are they?
I don't even know.
they're 4K and this.
I believe it's going to be a 5,000-watt bulb, but as far as everything else, I'm essentially trusting my partner on this one.
And your partner being Bill Peoples, who runs.
Yeah, Bill is the connecting thread of Ambassador Entertainment. He is the colony. Yeah, he has each one of our theaters is kind of its own little unique fiefdom with an ownership team. Bill is the connecting thread of each theater. He is either owns them outright, like the colony, he owns outright. The other three locations he has partners, but different partners in each one. So it's a nice little setup. He's kind of insulated. If one has trouble, the others are okay. So.
I'm trying to figure out where to go to next here because I've known you for a long time now, and I'd say we've had some sort of relationship. And
you want that hug now? Is that it?
I don't know. It may come soon, but it's a funny thing because, you know, I've come to rely on you because you're the guy who basically, like you mentioned at the top, gets movies, the low-budget films, the art house films, Warrens, whatever, in Raleigh for your theaters. And not only that, but also, you know, back when I was saying that we would screen movies here, this would be the place that we would all end up because it was just like
that. I really miss those days. You know, the screenings we would have, and there was that little group of guys. You know, Neil and Dave Fellerath would come over, and they were here. I always enjoyed those.
Yeah,
and it was a nice little revenue stream too. It's not like, you know, it was a pittance to the film companies to do these things, but it was a nice little chunk of change in our pockets for doing it. It was fun. I mean, who doesn't want to see a movie a few days before everybody else does so you can get the drop on
them? And also, I live not too far from where this is, so it was always never like a big problem. And that's kind of like the thing, hopefully, when the digital conversion happens, that, you know, we can get back to screening films here, but I don't know how that would be considering that. And then this is also a thing I was wondering, perhaps, is that you know, we had, when I was working at the NNO, since it was the main paper, I had kind of a big main relationship with you with seeing movies, and, like, I wouldn't have time to see a movie at the allotted time, and there would be times when you hold on to the film print, and you let me see it, like, later on in the day, you know.
Did that get us in trouble? Remember that gal at Sony Classics?
Yeah. It wasn't even her at Sony Classics. It was the publicist.
She was over.
Well, the first time you pissed her off was when we had a screening of Persepolis.
Oh yeah.
And we were all waiting outside, and it was like in the cold.
Yeah, my car broke down that day, so that just set the tone for
and none of us knew how to reach you, which was sad.
Bitter relationship,
I still don't have your numbers. I'm trying to, you know, make sure that never happened again. And that took like months of you basically having
just
to, and just then that never happened again and whatever. And just like, and she because she was all ready to go off to other different theaters and have screens there. But we all, I like, it wasn't just me. It was just a lot of people. We all chose like that's the place we all go to, and so, and then it came back here, and then there's this one shitty ass movie, Rudo e Cursi, which I don't even think you played here.
Oh, we didn't. Yeah, no. That's right. We never even played the movie.
Yeah, we didn't play it, and it was another one of those things where just like I couldn't make it at that time, and so I asked you to hold on to print for me so I could see it later in the day, and she found, well, as you emailed me and say, how are you gonna, you weren't there as a screen, so what are you gonna do late? Oh, that's no problem, Mike. John, let me see it, and then he let you see the print of the movie. Yeah, yes. Just like, and then it became this huge thing.
That I had not gone through her to set it up.
Yeah, and that didn't go through, because, the screen monitor wasn't there, and just like on one of the off chance, somebody will come in and bootleg the movie that didn't make shit in Chinese money.
Yeah.
And it was just a big blow up, and it really, it's bad enough I already have not the most bit of, how should I put this? They just get on my damn nerves. The publicists and everything, and just, because they're, especially, a lot of the publicists, and I've spoken with many critics on this podcast, and they've had many run-ins with publicists and how they just basically, just prevent you from doing your job.
Sure, sure.
And yeah,
it's funny, I think, as there's become more, what do you call it, ancillary profits from movies, DVD releases and pay-per-view stuff and whatnot. It's like the exhibition part of it is just, they don't care anymore. It's not like the movie's making all its money. It wasn't that long ago when a film would play in a movie theater for a year. Mm-hmm. It was nothing for it. When I started the Cardinal Theater over in North Hills, they had played Empire Strikes Back for over a year, E.T. for over a year. And now it's like, they call Raleigh a two-week town. There's so many theaters in Raleigh that, you really, you can go see a movie on opening night. You're not going to have to worry about selling out. You might not be able to see it where you want to see it, but you can see it. I mean, if it's something really big, they'll have it on at North Hills at like four or five screens.
Yeah.
They'll have it on at the Grand on four or five screens. It's just, you might have to hunt a little bit, whereas I kind of miss the days when I started. Everything was its own exclusive, which also made it really cutthroat, because if you got something that was a dog, you were really scrambling. But when I moved to Raleigh, the first two films we had at the Cardinal was this old Robert Redford thing called Legal Eagles. And Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah.
And even a little throwaway film like Legal Eagles played, 4 months, and Ferris Bueller was just, longer than that.
Yeah.
So now, if I play a movie here at the Rialto for like a month, people are busting our chops about, when are you going to get a new movie? When are you going to get a movie? They want to keep coming to see something new.
Yeah, because it's just the way of how things have progressed. Remember, I used to read James Wolcott's movie columns in Texas Monthly, and it's a monthly.
Mm-hmm.
So and that was back in those days where you could review movies for a monthly because the movies would be around.
Sure.
For a while and stuff. But it's not that way anymore. Just like everything's so accelerated.
Yeah, just the whole trickle-out release pattern, too, is, I remember, I grew up in Rona Rapids, which is up on the border with Virginia, and, we had three theaters in Rona Rapids, three screens, I should say, and, something would open up in Raleigh, and it would be, in Raleigh, which back, 40 years ago wasn't that big of a town, and you would still have to wait, couple of months before it got to Rona Rapids, even.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine if something opened up in New York before it got to Raleigh, and then Raleigh before it got to Roanoke Rapids, it just took a while. So yeah, of course, you could really write about it on all sorts of levels. And people were also looking to articles like that to see what's out there. What do I want to see? Now, not only is it television inundated with movie commercials, but it's like there's this whole industry online that's dedicated to finding out everything about a movie before it's even released. Yeah. You know, that's where it's nuts to me. I just I can go read the script for something that's in pre-production right now.
That's another thing. Like, of course, we know people who get off if we get it.
Yeah,
watching, reading, finding the scripts and reading them. Like, why would you even consider doing that? What game for you to read the script?
I mean, I can see it if you're like in the business.
Yeah.
And so you want to say, well, what's getting made and as opposed to what's not, and how can I, and if I want to be a screenwriter, do this. But it's like, if you're just some guy that says, I want to find out, the secret. It's amazing to me how, it's funny too, how the movies changed. I remember when Empire Strikes Back came out, people kind of sat on the fact that, Luke and Darth Vader are father and son. What I really remember firsthand is when we played The Crying Game, which the studio had really said, do not spoil the big little the surprise in the film. Don't, have your staff not talk about it. I mean, we got memos from Miramax saying, sit on this. Do not tell people. And it worked. People kind of got behind it and said, okay, well, we're not going to tell. But I can't imagine something like that happening.
Yeah.
If I want to find out something, even before it's out, I can find out.
Yeah.
And that kind of takes the fun away from it for me. It takes the fun away from viewer. But as you say, there's a whole bunch of people that they get the rocks off by,
this whole thing isn't really fun for me anymore. I don't know if you've noticed this.
Yeah.
I'm not really having a good time, John. I'm taking some antidepressants now, be quiet, so I can get back into the spirit of doing this again. And I just add some problems occasionally. Just can't do things certain. We're getting too personal with this, but But getting back to why publicists blow,
why publicists don't blow us.
Well, that too. Yeah, but, well, no, let's not deal with that. Let's not make this a whole...
Let's not make this about us.
No, let's not sexualize this or make this a whole misogynist thing. Because that's another thing, because, that's the general profile of publicists. They're young women.
Really?
Yeah, young women, usually in their 20s, mainly in their 20s. And they seem to be highly over emotional.
Well, based on the handful I've had to deal with, that would be, the over emotional part certainly applies.
Yeah, because it makes no sense why they would consider being emotional. Well, just taking this very seriously, because that was a funny thing. Because when that whole thing came down, when you screened the movie for me, the big problem that this particular publicist had was that we had a relationship where you could do that for me.
Yeah.
Like, she couldn't understand why, how could she be taken out? Because first of all, you're way in Atlanta, so you have no anything was going on over here. And, John is the guy we all talk to and come to about this stuff. So it'd be very easy just to talk to John and just...
She clearly also didn't appreciate how a market like this works. Is that back in
nobody
in,
does?
In, well, in those days, especially people, when they weren't just running wire services every time, it's like people knew who you were before you even knew who Todd Lothry was, before Todd knew who Bill Morrison was. It's like there was this body of work they could look at and say, well. I remember back when I was a kid, Bill Morrison writing TV and movie reviews, people would say, well, if Bill liked it, I didn't like it. So, but they would know, they were comfortable with that.
Yeah, and that was me the last couple of years.
Oh, they said, Craig liked it? Ah. But it's and so I would, it would make a big deal to me when a good review came out. Mm-hmm. You know, I would, and so I would want the local person to review it. I mean, good, bad, or otherwise, people at least knew where you were coming from. Mm-hmm. Whereas now you just pick it up and it's like, so and so from the Orlando Sentinel. Or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, Roger, who's this guy? It's like, It's like, I don't read this guy or her guy, her stuff every week. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they like Westerns over comedies or little thing like that. You know, just, I kind of miss that. I'm getting that more in television now that I have writers writing about television that I go to follow.
Yeah.
More so than it's the News Observer. I mean, it just, that's a whole different thing. Let me start off.
It's something we mentioned that, you know, a lot of people, that certain people see Raleigh as a two-way town, where just like, there seems to be this general opinion that it's always been something that perturbed me, if I may say that, about, just about people's opinion of Raleigh, because of course, you know, Raleigh, it's not just Raleigh, Durham, Iscariot, Chapel Hill, it's all connected together, and there's a lot of, there's a lot of theaters that play art house theaters. You know, it's yours, and there's the Chelsea and Chapel Hill and the Carolina and Durham, and there used to be the Galaxy and Cary before that shut down.
It used to be the studio. We ran the studio downtown, too.
Yeah, and that, too. So, just like, there is this obvious audience that, because of all the theaters here and all the people that go to these theaters, that there is an audience for a lot of these films, but there seems to be the general perception is that it's just Raleigh and it's the sticks, or, you know, there's nothing but fields or the woods, and people have this perception this is yokel country, and so they wouldn't be interested in a lot of the films that come out, and that's why I always take such a hassle to get these films down.
That was why I was really kind of, you know, when it became Madstone, when Madstone first opened mm-hmm. up, I was actually kind of interested to see what they would do, because
Madstone, before the Galaxy, it was the Madstone.
You know, so Rialto, with just a single screen, you have to really play your cards carefully, because that's your one revenue source. And I thought, Madstone, I'm thinking, okay, now here's an opportunity, they can sort of dedicate two screens to stuff that they're pretty confident about.
Well, Madstone was six screens.
You know? Yeah, but then they would have other screens. They could say, like, well, maybe let's play this, you know, Romanian docudrama and see how it goes, or something like that, which, as much as I may or may not want to see a movie like that, there's not enough of an audience to keep a single screen theater like this going. Mm-hmm. So, but unfortunately, I didn't think Madstone really went to that degree that I thought they were going to, and then when it became Galaxy, they opted more to sort of go with the Indian,
Bollywood audience.
Yeah, the Bollywood stuff, which there's definitely an audience for the Bollywood stuff that nobody was showing, so that was fine.
It's interesting you say a Romanian film, because there was another thing, you know, years ago, there's a piece done in Independent Weekly by a writer who doesn't live in the Triangle area, and he put a lot of art house theaters over to Kohl's for playing a particular Romanian film or something mm-hmm. like that. And it's funny, because reading that, because first of all, you know, I thought like this particular writer knew a lot about not just film but how film distribution worked. Mm-hmm. And like, I, you know, it seemed like I almost had this better idea of how film distribution worked in this other person. And I remember talking to you about that, and it was just like, you know, it was kind of like a surprising thing how a lot of people just have this idea of how films are run.
You can snap your fingers and do whatever you want. whenever you want.
Yeah, just a film just automatically comes down. I mean, I've had arguments about this with people.
Yeah.
Like, they would have, you know, I'll never forget, I have this argument with a friend of mine about that movie, Talk to Me, with Don Cheadle, and he said it's playing in D.C. and it's not playing in Raleigh yet, so it's apparently it's a racist conspiracy.
Where the movie was set, they play in the city where the movie was set.
Yeah. And I kept going, no, it's not a racist conspiracy. This is Raleigh. Nobody really considers Raleigh a big enough market to instantly open a movie like that. Yeah. It has to play in top primary markets before it gets down to secondary markets like ours. It's so difficult to explain to people. And just it's just this weird thing, like when you're automatically immersed in. And I still don't consider myself a part of the film industry or whatnot, but I report on everything. And I always thought that I had this general sense of how it's ran. But it seems that even when you have a general sense of how it's ran, you still know more than certain people about how the film business is run.
I get that. I see often things like that when people want to have a rental where they want to show a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just say, well, we want to play this.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say, I don't think I can find you a copy of that,
mm-hmm.
back before digital, of course,
yeah.
they would just be gobsmacked. They'd be like, why not? I saw it on TV just the other day. You know? Well, that's not the way it works.
Yeah.
I used to call that other, what you're talking about, I sometimes call that the tyranny of New York. Because, you know, you open up a film in New York,
yeah.
and if it flops, you know, quality issues aside, mm-hmm. if it flops, the studio would just bail on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, or, you know, also, there's been some instances where a distributor will buy a film right and just sit on it. They might open it up just as sort of as a sop to the producer, open it up in his hometown or something.
Yeah. Of course, the Weinsteins are legendary for that.
For that, yes. So that's all. You're right. I mean, there's all sorts of little nuances like that that go into just you getting a picture. So.
Yeah. According to the funny, like when you say, you know, when they want to rent a theater and find a print, first you got to find a print.
Got to find a print available. Yeah.
And then you got to like get rights to even screen the movie. And that's another thing I'm still trying to figure out. It's like, who do you give rights to and everything?
That's what certainly Denver runs into. It's like the films they show is from that guy's collection.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's show this. Well, let's find out who we have to pay to show it. And it's like they got to do a lot of legwork just to figure out who's... Because like you say, who gets assigned the rights, and then it starts getting passed around all over the place, and then... something really old maybe falls into public domain. I don't even know how that works. Because, you know, like, friggin' It's a Wonderful Life was in public domain for a run there. I guess somebody's bought it up at this point. But how the hell do you go about buying it up out of public? How do you buy something that's in public domain?
I mean, I did a story about that years ago, was back when, like, the Carborough Century Cinema, that they would have DVD screens of stuff, and just, like, they would just have to, very old movies... And that was their thing. They would get a lot of old movies that would be in the public domain, so they didn't have to pay for anything. And so that's usually how they ran things. And also, there's like the whole issue.
I think this was model work, right?
I believe I wrote a story where they ceased to exist. But but there's also the thing of, and it's also bringing back what you're just saying. Just like you just mentioned, just how it would, you know. You don't know if this is going to do well. You know, just don't know if it's going to make any money, especially with the repertory revival things. Like, would there be an audience? I mean, on the one hand, let's say, of course, you got the Museum of Art, and they definitely have their audience and art, and they come to see their movies, see the kind of movies they have, where opposed to, like, Cinema Overdrive over the Colony, which they play a lot of obscure films, a lot of films nobody knows about, but it's like it's not a major thing. But they do have like a cult audience and stuff.
Sure.
As would the films that they would attract when it first came out would get.
Right.
So it's just like it's very tricky, you know, getting movies played. And, you know, whether it's this market or another market. I mean, I was talking with Toby Leonard, who runs the Belcourt in Nashville, and we spent like an hour and a half one Saturday morning talking about this, how. Just, you know, even though, like, a place like the Belcourt, which is non-profit, they can have the tools or just the mechanics or the equipment to play a Sergio Corbucci retrospective before Django Unchained come out, that didn't make any money. I mean, it was something interesting to do, but it was not a lot of call for a Kabuchi retrospective right. in Nashville.
But the 10 people that came to see it probably were just excited.
Yeah, they were all... Jason Sean was moist when that retrospective happened. But yeah, it's just something, you know, once again, writing about this for, you know, past 8-9 years or so, you really get an understanding of how things work more than people who say they know how things work and everything. Just like, you know, you have like, you know, just you have, you know, you when you're a reporter, you write it, but you just basically have to assess all this stuff that you see and witness and report on. It's just,
and it's a weird business to begin with. I mean, just the mm-hmm. business of making movies is crazy. Just nuts.
Hell yeah.
And you know, we're on the, you know, the film exhibitors, we're kind of the white hats in the whole thing, is that we're following the rules and doing basically regular business practices, where the people that make movies, it's like crazy accounting, so no movie ever makes any money. And the way they just throw money at problems, it's crazy. It's still very ego-driven, even as they're becoming more and more corporate-oriented. I mean, there's still big personalities.
Yeah, I mean, it's starting to, like, you find out about the due date, like, you know, when a movie's going to come out first, before you know anything about
the movie. Yeah, it's like...
And just, like, don't do that!
Yeah.
It's like, you're just rushing yourself up for failure. Just like, you know, when that movie comes, it's going to suck ass. Because, you know,
you had to make the date.
Yeah, I had to make the date.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, especially like July 4th was like the big...
Yeah.
Things were pegged out on July 4th a year. Mm-hmm. You know, as you say, it's like, well, we got a script.
Yeah.
We'll have it ready by July 4th.
Yeah.
You know, forget about all the money you're going to spend on special effects. You're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
Not only quality thing, but if God forbid, you decide, well, this isn't what we want to put out, so let's work on it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then that means you push it back 2 months, and all of a sudden, you know, the fanboys are, the movie sucks.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're trouble on the set.
And that's a whole other thing, just like, because, you know, being a critic, if you want to call me that or something, it's just like you still have this sense when you review movies is that, you know, the whole thing about embargoes,
mm-hmm.
the embargo policy where you don't let anybody, you know, don't tell anybody on Twitter or whatever, or any advance word. But when you go see the movie, they'll have this big, gigantic card on the screen saying, if you like this movie, you know, go on Twitter and hashtag the movie and all that bullshit. And just like, oh, so these people who probably would never go to see the movie if it wasn't for free.
Yeah, right.
You're giving them carte blanche.
You brought up a very... The nomadic subculture of the free movie crowd.
Oh, jeez, man. Yeah. You, I think you already know my opinion of the free movie crowd.
The few times we've done it, I mean, one, we're always filling up.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll buy a lot of stuff. But
yeah.
It's people, I've never seen them anywhere else.
No.
They, you know, that is what they're here for. And they all come early because they know that they give out too many tickets
mm-hmm.
for these things. So... there's going to be, for a movie that starts at like 7:30, I guarantee you, at 6 o'clock, there's going to be people camped mm-hmm. up outside your door waiting to get in, because, by God, they really want to see Sweeney Todd before anybody
else
does.
Yeah.
So, wow. I have kind of a love-hate relationship with those things, because on one hand, you know, it's a rental, so you get to charge the studios a fee, and they buy a lot of stuff. You know, concessions are still where you make most of your money.
Yeah.
But holy crap! It's just an interesting crowd of people. I don't even know if they're really. You know how there's some people that just buy stuff because it's a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I got 100 pounds of butter because it's mm-hmm. 2-for-1. It's
yeah,
like yeah. And I think that people come here, they're only doing these things because it's free.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a dog and pony show. It could be a boxing match. Oh, it's a movie. Okay, that's great. It's free,
mm-hmm.
and there's a part of me, my there's a my movie lover soul is sometimes really annoyed by that. That you're not here to see whatever it is. You're here because it's free. It's like,
well, I mean, it's no question for a lot of people. It's, and because it's free, they don't treat it with the same investment that paid people do. Because I have been in theaters with people who have paid to see screens during the day with people. And it's like, I remember I saw Cabin in the Woods last year. And
with a bunch of freebies? Oh my God.
No. I saw that. I got paid to see it. It was a Tuesday night screening. And it was me and a friend of mine. And we sit in the back. And a bunch of college kids, college kids wearing the college kids uniform T-shirt, and Nike shorts, walking or heading up in the back, and okay, the movie's starting, and they could have been more quiet, they could have been more respectful. It was like they paid to get in and they want to see the movie, so it's just like people who go. People who put that's the thing I learned this years ago when I was watching when I went to go see a matinee of Not Another Teen Movie.
Okay,
because like when you pay, you play plunk down money and like to the part of like this could very well be a piece of shit, and you're just like you're just very you're almost concerned because it is investment.
You're making a bet. It's like put that money down.
Yeah, it's like you're taking a chance.
Right.
But it's moving to entertain you, and if it can you, so you are fully invested on the experience. But when you're like, is when it's free, when it's crowded, when there's a radio station giving away shit, when God damn it, this is like the preview audience experience always, it's always been an experience for me, and it's like an awkward experience. And just
that, you've actually twinned me on something else that's annoying is talking about you're being asked to embargo your information, whereas they're encouraging the knuckleheads.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, the other customers to
not tweet. Customers.
It's like, look at this stuff, and then preview. Look at the stuff they put in previews now. They give away everything in a preview, for crying out loud.
Talking about the trailer?
Yeah, maybe? I mean, you and me, we call them trailers, but who calls them trailers anymore?
Yeah, well, I still...
Yeah, it's like, I still remember, it was that first Mission Impossible movie, and they showed essentially the money shot, where
Tom
Cruise gets blown off the helicopter down the tunnel and lands on the thing. We're going, why the hell did you show that? That's your big stunt of the movie, and you just gave it away.
No, why? Because it's actually this thing. I don't know if you heard this, where it's like a trailer. You have to have at least 3 to 5, especially for blockbusters, 3 to 5 shots that they put in the trailer to show how exciting and explosive the movie is.
I guess the comedy, they want to have like 3 to 5 good lines.
Yeah, and those are usually the good lines in the whole movie.
Yeah, or if they don't have a good line, you're going, fuck, I'm not going to go see that.
No, I find like the comedies with that don't have the good lines in the trailer, there's actually a chance it might be funny. They're just like,
I'm going to say, if you couldn't come up with a good line to sell the movie, it's like, you're relying on me to trust your
once again, goes back to you know when people pay to see, go to the matinees, go to wherever.
Yeah.
It's like they're putting
come on, Lucky Seven.
It's but it's funny because I actually prefer. It's gotten a point now where I just prefer to pay and go see a movie. Like, remember that whole the opening scene in Lost in America where the radio is on and Rex Reed is talking about, and I can't believe I'm talking about Rex Reed, but just like it's
he's been in the news lately.
because he's talking about how he prefers to see a movie during the day with an audience because you feel like get the actual experience. And this was something even Roger Ebert wrote about before he passed away, where he said that, I went to see a movie, with an audience, who wanted to be there.
Right. See, that's the important distinction right there. Yeah. You want to watch it with like-minded people.
Yeah.
You want to watch it as you say, your freebie crowd that's just there to
kill
2 hours. You know, so
vagrants.
The best movie-going experience, one of the best I've ever had, was we drove down to Raleigh when Empire Strikes Back opened up.
Yeah.
And it was playing at the old Cardinal Theater. It was a 70mm print.
Yeah.
It was a 700, that had an auditorium that was 750 people, and that place was packed, and it was packed with people that were like, we love Star Wars, and we weren't expecting a sequel, and boom, here it is, we are ready for it. And that was like 750 people that were like, there to see the movie. If you had caused any sort of disruption, you would have been killed.
Yeah.
And it's like, people were focused.
Yeah.
That was great. It was fantastic. And nowadays, I'm just kind of like, I kind of like to go see a movie by myself, just sit in the auditorium. And
I much prefer. With the press screening, I'm like, yeah, I don't feel like it. I don't have enough money for gas in my car. Secondly, I still don't feel like it. And like, I don't know if I could sit just in trance 2 hours. even though Rosario Dawson is just apparently naked as a jaybird all in that movie.
Now I must see this movie.
Yeah, that's the worst part. Just like, oh, she's naked, but I have to sit through a Danny Boyle movie. Shit.
Boy, there's talk about your flip a coin director right there. This one's some Danny Boyle films I've enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, it's funny because like I went on Twitter just like I didn't see it, but I asked like, is it as red bullish as all his other movies? Like just like this accelerated form of cinema, just like it is kind of interesting. Like it's just this accelerated form of cinema, just basically about just people who just are lonely and walk alone.
Yeah. Pretty just much. Like walk on very fast.
Yeah, or just like I actually listened to the the online interview with Elvis Mitchell did with Danny Boyle after a trans screening, and mentions how just like a lot of the protagonists in Danny Boyle films are these like Ewan McGregor and Trainspotting, James Franco and 127 Hours.
See, James Franco, there's the essence of what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, because it's like he's this guy, just like I walk along. He's just like, he sees Kate Mara and Amber Tamblyn in just walking past, and instead of like having a in the middle of the desert three way, he's just like, nah, I'm just gonna go.
See you later.
Yeah, bye. I'm gonna get my arm wedged between a rock. It's just like.
Sound better and better.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man, but
yeah, that really is it, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, did you play 127
Hours? Yes, we did.
Did people pass out when he cut off his arm?
They didn't as much. That's an interesting thing because it's sort of the tolerance level of the audience, of the general audience, has gotten a lot stronger.
Yeah.
Because I remember I worked in a theater that played the original Alien.
Yeah.
And boy, when that thing popped out of John Hurt's chest,
oh yeah,
people came running out of the auditorium. They were like, oh my God, ah! And then when we played Pulp Fiction here many years ago, that bit where the adrenaline shot in the chest, on at least 6 occasions I had people pass out in the auditorium. I mean, just get up and fall right in the aisle. And that was, what was Pulp Fiction? Was that
94?
94. We're coming up on 20 years ago now, and it's so something like that, which is pretty disgusting.
Yeah,
it's a very strong image. Let's say people just kind of took it all in stride.
Really? Because
of course, you're going to get it too.
Yeah,
it's not like I will say the thing about Alien and the chess scene.
Yeah, you didn't see it coming.
You didn't see any of that stuff coming.
I remember I saw that on a Wednesday morning at 7 o'clock. Before I went to school. Now, that's an interesting thing to start your day off with. Just like, hey, see somebody.
One of my stronger memories of Alien is the manager saying, oh, I'm thinking, I got to change the marquee. Alien, that's awesome. I can change this. Like, what? A few letters? And then the manager goes, yeah, I want you to put up there in space, no one can hear you scream. I was like, fuck!
Yeah.
Dude, come on.
Yeah, wow. just want to put that emphasis up there.
That was a fun movie to work, though. That was There's certain movies that come along that are a lot of fun to work because you know people are gonna, you know that people are gonna get something they're not expecting, and it just really, you know, going back to the Crying Game, I used to sneak in the auditorium and just stand in the back when the, wasn't it Jay Davidson?
Yeah.
His name just sort of revealed himself.
Yeah.
You would get a wide variety of reactions. Usually drop dead silence when people just kind of just washed over them that they had been completely fooled by this and it kind of messed up their worldview in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And then all you would just get some interesting reactions from the crowd there. So.
Was there any specific ones? Could you?
I had a woman call me up after the movie. She called me up and she said, "Have you seen that movie?" I was like, "Yeah." So, you know, that's you're showing this. You're not warning the public. You're not warning them. And I was taking the polite. Well, you know, the studio is really adamant that they want us to sit on that information and not give it out so the audience can be surprised. And you're okay with this? You're okay with this? I was like, well, yes, ma'am. She said, that's because you're a sick gay man, too.
Wow.
Okay. I guess we won't be seeing you again. Thanks so much.
Hey, well, that's another thing, because I was over at the Colony not too long ago, and I was talking with Denver, and they were playing the trailer for Spring Breakers before Quartet.
That's kind of a miscue.
Yeah, and so old people would walk out the theater after Spring Breakers. Like, keep in mind, you played Spring Breakers. And say that this movie is disgusting. I never see a movie. Keep in mind, that was just a trailer. They did say everything. And just like, it's like you never know what exactly is going to turn people off. And it makes me wonder just how was that when you played Spring Breakers? I mean,
I got the stink eye from a lot of people. It was, a lot of people just didn't come and then gave me shit about it after we showed it. But, you know, my argument would be it's a director whose body of work so far, love it or hate it, is much more in keeping with the kind of stuff we show.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we show Trash Humpers, mind you. But, you know, we did show Gummo. We did, you know, what he wrote, Kids. We showed Kids back in the day. And it also was released by, this was the first film released by a new distribution company.
Yeah.
They came to us to show it. Mm-hmm. And so, one, I'm kind of cultivating a connection. And because who knows, you know, maybe, you know, who's going to blame them saying, hey, I'm going to show the Harmony Korine movie. It's like, and maybe next time they'll get something that really catches fire. And since we worked with them before, we'll be the first people they come to. And again, and it's a Harmony Korine movie. It's like.
But once again, you act like people know
who Harmony Korine is.
It's like, yeah. I mean, it's such a.
I expect at least our customers, a percentage of our customers to know who that is. And even if they go, well, who's that? I can say, well, did you see Gummo? Did you see Kids? I didn't ask them if they saw Trash Humpers. But at least they know some of these movies. By reputation. So I can kind of get across there. But a lot of people are just like, you know, what you got in that movie was so unlike the bill of fare we usually offer. So a lot of, you know, people kind of gave me the fish eye. Some people, most people just kind of laughed. And shrugged it off. But it's like, but a lot of like, wow, you played Silver Linings Playbook for 3 months and this is your first movie after that. So, haha. But
and then also Silver Linings, once again, I don't know how much you want to get into because that's a Weinstein Company movie.
It is.
And
it is.
You had quite the rocky relationship with Weinstein Company.
Oh, we've had a pretty good relationship with them. More or less. It's, well, when it was Miramax, you know, we were their theater in Raleigh. And, you know, everything they came out, we wanted to play. In their new conception, they seem to have sort of righted the ship a little bit in terms of the kind of stuff we play. Because they've won, like, what, the past 3 Best Pictures have been theirs. And we've played them. So, I mean, it seems like a lot of their stuff is a little bit more accessible than it used to be.
Yeah.
And they don't, and they are still, How wide a listenership do you have? They're still one of the companies that makes, can be capable of making snap decisions that you don't necessarily know. You know, like for instance, Silver Linings Playbook, for the longest time, we were told it's going to be a commercial release only, it's going to be a commercial release. And so along that line, it opened up at the Crossroads in Cary, I think around Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And every time we would ask about it, they said, well, we're going to go wide in a week or two. We're going to go wide in a week or two. Mm-hmm. And we were told that, and we were told that, and we were told that. And then, you know, like 10 days before Christmas, they called up and said, yeah, we want to open up Silver Linings Playbook at the Rialto on Christmas Day. And we're like, okay, you know. But there's certainly been other films that they'll yank a release date around. You know, mm-hmm. we'll have a film booked that all of a sudden is just pulled out of the release date. I mean, their national release calendar for whatever reason. I can't, there was something last year, was, I forget the name of it, Something Girl, that we had the previews up, had posters up, had a date on it.
Had a Juno Temple movie?
Yeah, it might have been it. Yeah. It might have been it. And then it was just pulled, and then never saw it. So it's, maybe it got released on VOD or something. I don't know. It might have been the Juno Temple movie, but it might have been. It just was such a blip on the radar. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't like we were looking at it to do a big thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they've got a film out right now called The Sapphires.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm kind of going, well, is that, I'd be happy to play that movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the comic is pretty, you know, recognizable. Yeah. It seems like it looks like a pretty generic film, but it's something to play, and this time of year you're kind of looking for something to play. Mm-hmm. So, but who's to say it'll even play in Raleigh? Because I can't count on them making that decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, all their decisions are made by, you know, their business interests. They know what's best for their company. And this is where I backtrack crazy. They know what's best for their company, so. Mm-hmm. They're making decisions, bigger decisions than just what's good for my theater. So I understand that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, sometimes, you know, you get a film and you want to promote it. You want to let people know it's coming, you know. And if it's yanked at the last minute, well, that's kind of painful. Or if they book something in at the last minute, you got to kind of scramble to make sure people know it's out there. So.
Well, yeah, that's the way of... I mean, that's the way it is for just a lot of the art house films, especially around here, just like as one, because, you know, it'll be in 10. It's always on that Monday morning, because that was always the thing I really knew.
Yeah, Monday's when you schedule.
Yeah, so we all had to wait to see what you guys would say on Monday.
That's where the screaming matches would be, because these guys that you played their movie last week, and if you did okay with it, but there's another bigger film that you know you're really going to kick ass with set for that Friday, you know, then your booker starts getting into a shouting match with the film seller because he doesn't want to have his film yanked because it's still making money. And there's a lot of, like, chest thumping by these guys that, you know, our film is out on so many screens and its per site average is really good. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So I'm glad I have a booker to do all that. I just tell the booker what I want to play, and he's the one that has to go deal with all this mess.
How the hell are you getting this game, anyway?
Well, as a kid, I liked going to the movies. I grew up about two blocks from a movie theater, an old turn-of-the-century 1,100-seat movie theater with a balcony. And I used to go there every Saturday afternoon, you know, see whatever they're showing. That was back in the days when Disney was churning out, you know, nature films and live. Dean Jones was the making all the Disney films and whatnot. And I just liked going to the movies. And so when it came time for me to find a job, I was like, well, I wouldn't mind trying to find it, you know, work in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. So I got a job working at a drive-in when I was 15.
Yeah.
And first movie I ever worked, Joe Don Baker double feature.
Oh, okay.
Framed and Walking Tall Part 2.
Oh, okay.
And it just kind of gotten, you know, to a certain extent, it's like being in show business. It's a pale reflection of show business, but this the movie theater business is rife with guys like me, guys that have just been doing it and doing it and doing it forever. Mm-hmm. That's what we're going to do. It's like, I enjoy it. I enjoy watching people have, I mean, having people, giving people the opportunity to have a good time. I love going into the movie theater when there's a particular scene that I know is going to have a good reaction. I just really dig that. So, yeah. And plus, I get to sleep late for the most part. So there's that.
Well, you know, as we established earlier, just like, you know, if you're not here at a certain time, you know, it might bite, come back and bite you in the ass.
Yeah, well, I swear that was my car broke down.
Okay. All right, but, well, yeah, I mean, I believe it, but, you know, of course, other people in Atlanta, other high-strung human beings in Atlanta who...
held that against me.
Yeah, Jesus, but,
that
you know...
That was a star-crossed relationship.
Yeah, exactly, but... Yeah, didn't you meet a lot of interesting characters at the drive-in? Didn't it, on one occasion you met one Russ Meyer?
I met Russ Meyer here. It was awesome.
Oh, really?
Fantastic. It was you know, when they re-released Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, and yeah, it actually had a bit. You know, it was, you know, doing pretty good. And Meyer was self-distributing that.
Yeah.
You know, and so you know we were about a week out. Mm-hmm. From showing it, and we get this call. It's essentially, "Hey, I'm Russ Meyer." Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I'll be coming into town for the release of this movie, so line up some interviews for me. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. So he came in, he just showed up in his car.
Was this Bill, the Bill Morrison era?
Yeah, Bill Morrison was the guy that I remember Bill Morrison. Bill Morrison, they sat in the lobby, and they talked for like 3 hours, because Mr. Myers just ramble on, and when he left, Bill Morrison just kind of looked at me, and he was like, and I don't know if you ever talked to Bill, but he had this very soft southern voice. He was like, "John, that was 3 fascinating hours, but I don't know what I'm going to do with any of that."
Yeah.
So... it was, so yeah, we had him, we took him out to dinner that night, mm-hmm. and he told some great stories about, you know, filming his movies, and after that he was gone.
So. And some raunchy stories as well.
Oh, yeah, he was telling this one story, I think it was a movie of his called Mud Honey,
mm-hmm.
and I've not seen that one, but he said it essentially involved this guy who looked like Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Making it with some, of course, buxom blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl is like, I think, a straddling Hitler's face or something. And they're supposed to be just, you know, simulating it.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy playing Hitler knows a good thing when he sees it, so he's going to be going for it. Mm-hmm. And so Meyer is telling me all about how the girl keeps going, you know, "Hitler's eating me out." It's like, that's right. And of course, we're sitting in this restaurant where he's telling a story, and he's getting increasingly inebriated as we're talking the story. And his voice is getting louder, and there's this family at the table right beside us. And there's like a 10-year-old kid who is just staring at our table, just soaking it all in. And he, and Mars, and they're telling the story, and he kind of takes a sip of his martini, and he just sees the kid looking at him, and he's like, "Hey, kid," and then just goes back to his story. So, it was a hoot. Remember talking about how Tura Sultana had to have sex all the time. She'd be in her trailer while they were filming the movie. She'd be dragging in, you know, crew members into her trailer. So he told I don't know if it's true or not. He claimed that he had taken that iconic picture of James Dean from Giant, mm-hmm. where he's like sitting in the back of the jalopy with his feet up and mm-hmm. the cowboy hat down. He claimed that he had taken that photo.
Well, of course, you know, he's like a, you know, photographer.
He was still a photographer.
Claimed
that he had lost his virginity in the Second World War when mm-hmm. Hemingway took him to a cat house in Paris.
Yeah.
So, who cares if it's true or not? It was good stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a fun time. I met Lassie. That was a good one. So I have Russ Meyer to have Lassie.
How did that go down, Lassie? Because I remember there's that movie.
Yeah.
That Lorne Michaels produced movie of Lassie.
Yeah, Peter O'Toole, man. Come on.
Yeah.
It was fine. They drove Lassie up in her own bus, and she was was very gracious and said hello to all her fans. Didn't make any special demands and didn't pee on the carpet, so it was all good.
Okay, so it was basically Russ Meyer and Lassie.
That's my two, yeah. And there'd been a... Who else have I really met that was really a thing? What was his name? Kevin...
Kevin Smith?
No, I wish. Kevin Reimer, maybe? Character actor who's... Oh. He was in... They filmed a movie here at the Rialto once. It was a film called Bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a big deal. We shut down for like 4 or 5 days while they filmed a lot of scenes here. And it was just a little independent movie that did a little chunk of change. But one of the guys in it was, we have the technology. So now I'm going to look this up on my IMDb while we're talking. But he's the one guy that, from that cast, kind of went to have a real career. Because he'd been in a number of movies. He was... Sorry, just to bring the interview to a crashing halt while I satisfy my own curiosity here.
No, we're all getting to that age where
I'm very focused now. I must know. Okay, Kevin, your name was R.
I mean, you can guess, what movie you saw this guy in?
Oh, yeah, I should just look up Circus Monkey. See, you're more much of a Google ninja than I am.
A Google what?
Yeah,
ninja, all right.
No, that's not it. What's Circus Monkey? It was Bandwagon.
Yeah.
Circus Monkey was the name of the band in Bandwagon.
Yes. They're both on our iPhones right now. It was made in 1996.
Right.
Starting Emma Caulfield.
Kevin Corrigan.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right.
Because he went ahead. He had a pretty good career.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good. A lot of good scenes of the Rialto in there back in the day. You really see what the place looked like before the renovation. It was. Mm-hmm. He was in The Departed. Yeah, look, he did a ton of stuff. Pineapple Express. Superbad. So now we're going to talk about Kevin Corrigan. I've met Kevin Corrigan.
All right, that's cool. I like he look as stoned as he usually looks.
He was much younger then. He was, pretty much.
All right.
not that I saw him do anything, but he was.
All right. I mean, okay. So you've lived this long career, this involved with movies
in
and
the
all
dark,
that
yes.
stuff and everything. I mean, is there an end game? Is there just something, is this something you feel you can do until you basically croak around here? I don't know why I'm taking it to such a morose point.
Well, trust me, it's like when you hit 50, you think about things like that.
Because you got a family now, right?
I do have a family now, and that is certainly... Having a 3-year-old next month will be 3-year-old son. He's gonna be in school during the daytime pretty soon. Which right now it's cool because I can see him during the day and we're having fun and whatnot. But at night, once he's a little older, nighttime's gonna be my primary time that I would see my son, see my family, and we'll see how that goes, but. On the other hand, I've been doing this for so long, I honestly don't know what else I could do or would do.
If Robert Redford told you, like, hey, we're opening a Sundance Cinemas here, right?
That'd be a tough call just because. I will say it does weigh on me that the Rialto has been here since 1942, and I don't want to be the guy who's running it when it gives up the ghost. You know, this place has been here 71 years, and I see no reason to believe it's going anywhere. It enjoys this interesting space of being the. Your sort of your specialty theater, your neighborhood theater, your old Raleigh theater. Theater. Right? Mm-hmm. We're the last of the old Raleigh theaters that's still up and running. And, I mean, and that's an appeal in and of itself for a lot of people. So
I mean, they used to have theaters all up and down Fayetteville Street. And those were the
oh, the, hey, the movie I'm Iggy Pop. Sorry.
What?
I met Iggy Pop. How's that?
Oh. Okay, all right.
Sorry.
Brent brought that up with the, okay.
Well, but you know what
I just saw him in a Chrysler commercial. Yes.
It's funny, you talked about it, what we used to do, and, you know, all the theater show, we used to also have bands here back in the day.
Yeah.
So. Sorry. Oh, yeah, there's somebody on it. I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to retire, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a business where you make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
People that work in this business are doing it because they love movies, mm-hmm. for the most part, and people that are with it for more than 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I really, even today with a kid, I don't get a chance to watch movies that often, but I still love being a part of it. I love mm-hmm. people coming in and seeing something and having that communal experience that they can enjoy. That's what keeps me here, one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, some of the more physical aspects of it I might not be able to do in the next 10 years or so. I mean, there can be, you know, when you are your own, when you're an owner, I mean, Bill has to do all sorts of crazy stuff on his own
mm-hmm.
that involves hard work, you know, sweat equity to keep a business going. And so that's, you know, I don't know. Will I be able to do some of these things I'm doing now? I mean, just, I tell you, one reason I'm glad that the digital revolution is here is I won't have to be walking these film canisters up the step, because those fuckers are heavy. I'm getting old, man. It's like, we had a manager at Six Forks Station fall down the stairs over there and die.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It was a real tragic story, and he was just carrying some boxes of stuff down the stairs and lost his balance. And when that happens, I can guarantee to you, your wife is going to bring that up.
Yeah. So,
you know, we really are in a morbid bent here right now. So I will see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So I don't see myself leaving this to go do something else.
I mean,
unless it's something in the movie business, maybe, you know, more of an archival or curator sort of thing. But
yeah. Well, that's what I was talking about, like, you know,
sure,
we had mentioned running Sundance Cinemas where you want to run that and everything, and just I don't know. Yeah, sorry if it ended, you know, ended quite morbidly, but that's, if you listen to the podcast, I've been going to a lot of dark places as of lately, and that's sadly.
Glad to know I'm part of the team.
Yeah, well, you know, just trying to do some stuff like that. It's probably a messed up thing to mention, but like you just mentioned, the guy who, the Six Forks who died and everything, and I think, like, wasn't there talk, like, of trying to replace him, and I was trying to see if I could do that, and that didn't really come into fruition. Didn't they put up a posting or something?
I mean, I honestly, I don't keep up with them too much. I mean, I thought they hired a guy from within over there.
That seems to be a general gist of. I don't like a job here.
You and everybody else.
I thought
of Jennifer. Jennifer does all the hiring now.
Did I piss off? Which one is Jennifer?
She was the blonde when you walked in.
The blonde, okay. I give her my resume and everything. Just like, I don't know.
Well, let's face it, we don't hire a lot of people. Once they're here, they stay. So.
Bring Dan in just through to do all this stuff and all the other theaters. I just said you see him a lot.
I forgot about Dan. When did Dan get hired over to Colony, anyway?
I don't know, but, like, he's been there for a long time, and then, of course, I would see him over here, and then I was thinking I'd see him in Mission Valley, so yeah.
Is he working in Mission Valley now,
too? I thought he worked in Mission Valley.
Holy crap.
Yeah, so exactly. I guess it's all incestuous.
Yeah, that's how we roll here.
Yeah, shit. did this turn out well for you, sir?
Oh, yeah. It got me a memory, remembering a few things I hadn't thought about in a while. I forgot all about the Russ Meyer weekend, though.
Yeah. Never done jail time, Aaron. Okay, so don't make me go up and look for a picture of you on Google, and then I see you on BustedMugshots.com.
You're not going to find me on BustedMugshots. You might not even be able to... Just look at Facebook. Plenty of shots on Facebook.
Yeah, it's always, it's always this is a shock when you're going on Google and just like all of a sudden, what the fuck? He was in jail. What the hell? Just missed it.
I wonder if you Googled me up if you would even find a picture of me. I've done a pretty good job of being a hermit.
It's just the age of the Google and everything, so your information is out there no matter what. So.
I know it's like you can find out my biography, no problem, and quotes attributed to me and things like that, but is there a picture of me floating around out there?
I'm pretty sure I'll be able to find one at some point.
I'm curious what you turn up.
Yeah, so. I'll be curious too.
It seems way too narcissistic to Google yourself. Everybody does it, right?
But yeah, I do it. I do it all the time. Just remind myself I matter. But,
well, tell me. I'll be curious to see what you find.
Okay. And, this is usually the time when I ask people, where can they find you online if they want to look for you online?
Well, I'm really not online too much. Just check out ambassadorcinemas.com for our film schedule. How's that? Mm-hmm. How lame is that?
Well, I mean, don't you? Well, wait a minute. Who does the Twitter stuff? Is that you or Denver?
Denver does.
Denver does. Okay. So you don't have a Twitter handle and anything?
No. Sorry. Right. Don't do the Twitter.
Okay.
Don't know how.
Yeah. Don't know how. Well, just Twitter and just, anything else like a Pinterest page or anything like that?
Don't have a Pinterest page.
All right. you really are a Luddite, I'd say.
I am proud of it.
Okay, man. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for taking part in this lovely, whatever the hell this was. And good luck with the digital transference
or
conversion, we like to call it. I'm just losing words at this point. But thanks. Thank you for everything. And as always, this is Craig D. Lindsay just saying, 1997, we'll get to you one of these days.